Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dude's perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
We're back in the saddle again after a week off.
Yeah. Sorry to everybody out there in radio land, but I was too busy. I had to go down and fight the hurricane.
Down there battling the hurricane?
Yeah, in Disney World.
Yeah. It's a good thing you didn't have to go through Alabama.
Oh, I know. I heard Alabama got hit hard.
They were feeling the effects.
Yeah, the president circled them in specifically. But we had the boys, my Bim Bam, was performing in Atlanta and then in Orlando. And so they scheduled their first ever whole family Disney vacation. So all the McElroys were down there. And, of course, we were down there.
All the McElroys you can fit under a roof.
That's right. They were all down there. And so it was a big gathering. So all the cousins got to get together and the brothers and the in-laws and the outlaws. And so then this hurricane.
Are you one of the outlaws?
I'm an outlaw. So then the hurricane pops up.
I figured you would
up.
Like to take that moniker.
Yeah, that's right. Outlaw Josie Wales.
Outlaw Tommy Smurl.
But nobody would let the hurricane dissuade them. We just went ahead and went anyway. We didn't change plans or anything. We went on down. They canceled the boys' show in Orlando. The venue did.
Yeah.
Because they, at the time, were under a voluntary evacuation.
In Orlando?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, because that was when the first hurricane was first charted, it was showing going through Orlando.
Yeah.
So they were saying that they were going to have problems there, too. So the venue canceled the event. So we went on down to Disney a day early. And we said, we are not afraid of no hurricane.
Yeah.
We rode one out down there, Hurricane Aaron in 1995. Me and Mary and Sydney and Taylor were little. Riley was still a twinkle in her eye.
Yeah.
But they were little, but we were down there and rode out Hurricane Aaron.
How were the lines?
There were none.
That's awesome.
Everything down there was 5 and 10 minutes. I mean, you could go on Space Mountain or what's the new Star Wars one?
Did you get to go to the Star Wars thing?
I didn't get to go. I missed out on it.
Yeah.
But most of the rest of our group did go. Charlie rode on it.
Oh, nice.
Along with Justin. And they
pretty
had a great
interested
time.
In seeing that.
Yeah, they did build their, what do you call them?
Lightsabers,
yeah.
Ooh.
They built those. They all got the personal ones. Some of them built droids.
Hmm.
So I guess they took those back home with them. I don't think you leave them there to breed or something.
Those were the droids they were looking for?
Yeah, that's the ones. They found them. So anyway, we went there, and we had perfect weather. I mean, there was like 5 or 10 minutes of sprinkles here or there on a couple days.
Yeah.
But we didn't even have rain.
Yeah.
We just had beautiful weather and no lines for the whole week.
Well, the hurricane did do a lot of damage, especially in the Bahamas.
Oh, yeah.
It was really bad there. It just sat there on top of it. Just like stalled out.
Just ground them like hamburger.
It did.
But back to work now. Party time's over.
That's right.
We're back. We made it. So here we go.
Well, this episode, I came across an article on Reddit. Are you you ever on Reddit, Tommy?
I never am on Reddit. I've come across it a few times in research. You know, if I'm looking something up for an episode, and it'll have some reference on Reddit. But I don't normally go to it and look at it.
Reddit is actually one of my go-to websites I like to go to.
Yeah?
I'm quite the Redditor. I have a large amount of internet karma. I've even had two people like my post before.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Crazy.
I try not to post much.
No, I don't post much either. I just kind of lurk. Lurk and upvote.
Yeah, I comment, but I don't post.
Ah.
Not on Reddit, though. Just Facebook.
One of the subreddits I follow is like Unsolved Mysteries, and they had this thing on there called the Bloody Benders.
The Bloody Benders.
Kind of piqued my interest, and I really hadn't heard of them before.
Me neither.
The era we're talking about here is a little bit after the Civil War, and the U.S. government had moved the Osage, a Native American tribe, to a reservation in Oklahoma from the present-day area where they were historically from, which would be Kansas. So this basically made Kansas available to be settled under the Homestead Act.
Mm-hmm.
So the Homestead Act, we'll talk about that real quick. That was basically an area of 160 acres or 65 hectares that would be granted to any U.S. citizen willing to settle on and farm the land. And this was passed back in, I think, 1866.
Were they just trying to get people to develop that area?
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, what they did is they moved the Native Americans out, and they wanted to settle it, so they gave incentives for people to move there and to kind of develop the area a little bit.
Yeah.
So, basically, in order to perfect your acquisition of land, there was a three-step process. You had to file an application, you had to improve the land, and then file for the patent or the deed. And any citizen who had never taken up arms against the U.S., that include, so basically they were trying to eliminate for any kind of Confederates who were going out there. They didn't want
the Confederates going out there and gathering again,
probably,
huh?
Probably not.
Yeah.
Was at least 21 years or older, or the head of a household, could file an application to claim a federal land grant. Women were eligible too, and the occupant had to reside.
That was damn big of them back in those days.
Yeah. Yeah. The occupant had to reside on the land for 5 years and show evidence of having made improvements. And the entire process had to be complete within 7 years. So this is kind of that same time period as Laura Ingalls Wilder, like Little House on the Prairie and all that. It's kind of that same kind of basically era.
You figure the government had like homestead inspectors that drove out there from Washington, D.C. to go check and decide if they had improved the land in 7 years and all that kind of stuff?
Well, from my understanding, from what I've read about this, it was pretty much no law out there. It was a lawless land.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Some of my research sounds like it, too, especially in Kansas.
Oh, yeah.
That was where most of your gangs roamed around and everything. I mean, when you read about, you know, Jesse James and all those other kind of things.
Yeah, because
Youngers and all that group.
There was no law out there because Kansas was not a state. So there was no state law. It wasn't incorporated or anything like that. It was just like a territory.
Yeah.
So basically any kind of justice out there was pretty much vigilante justice or any kind of little local town probably that passed any kind of little laws or whatnot. So there really wasn't much law.
Yeah.
And you got to think, really too, wasn't. Back then that was pretty much, that was the Wild West. Like there wasn't much farther out than that. There's a big gap. So
big gap.
So in 1870, October of 1870, actually, and this occurred quite a long time ago, obviously. Well, I mean, historically speaking, not really a long time ago, but for fact-checking purposes, quite a long time ago, because there really isn't a great written record. And there's a lot of, it's hard to differentiate fact from fiction with this story.
Couldn't they just look on the internet?
They didn't have the internet back then.
What? No internet? How did they live? How did the Russians influence them moving out there?
I don't know. Maybe they were spiritualists, like the five families in October of 1870 that settled there.
Yeah.
And they settled in the township of Osage in northwestern Labette County, which is approximately 7 miles northeast of where Cherryvale would be established 7 months later. And one of the families was Ma and Pa Bender. John Bender Sr. and his son, John Bender Jr., they each registered 160 acres of land adjacent to the Great Osage Trail. And it was basically the only open road for traveling further west at that time. And they built a cabin, a barn with a corral, and as fall of 1871, Ma Bender and their daughter Kate arrived, and the cabin was divided into two rooms by a canvas wagon cover. So basically, it was one room, and they had a canvas wagon cover kind of
made the wall, the dividing wall. And they lived behind it, and they ran an inn in front of it.
That's right. And this wall becomes important later on in the story.
That's right.
So the Benders used a small room, like I said, for living quarters. They also had a little vegetable garden and a little apple orchard north of the cabin. So it sounds like a nice little picturesque little house on the prairie, right?
Right. Nice little bed and breakfast with home-cooked meals.
Yeah. Come and stay for a while.
Right. Fresh-grown veggies.
Or longer.
Yeah. Come and be a part of the soil.
Supposedly, Paul Bender, he was about 60 years old and didn't speak much English, and he was very, talked to a lot of grunts. He was not very well-spoken individual.
He was thought to be of German descent, that he had immigrated over from Germany at some point.
But what I've researched on the internet, there's actually not any records of where he came from, so we're not really sure.
Well, there's not actually any records to prove what his name was.
That's true.
So they're not sure if that was even really his name or a moniker.
Exactly. His wife was Elvira Bender. That's Ma Bender. Or I guess Elvira.
Elvira, Queen of the Darkness.
Yeah, that might be where that name came from, too, actually.
It could be.
It could have been passed along.
Yeah.
And she also didn't speak very much English, but she was supposedly very unfriendly, and the neighbors started calling her the She-Devil. Junior. John Bender Jr., he was supposedly about 25 years old, somewhat handsome, and spoke English, but with a German accent, and he laughed a lot, so people thought that he was kind of a half-wit.
Anybody who laughs a lot is a half-wit. That's why they think that about me.
Yeah, me too. Kate Bender, the sister, she was about 23 and was supposedly very attractive. She spoke English as well. She had some special techniques. She was supposedly a healer and a psychic. And she actually, and there's still some of these, you can find them on the internet, she put out flyers advertising her supernatural powers and her ability to cure illness. So she'd have seances and things like that. One of the things that she also advocated was free love. So there were some thoughts that...
She was ahead of her time. Yeah. Instead of the 1860s, she was supposed to be in the 1960s.
Yeah, there were some thoughts that she possibly lured people in with her free love.
She was flirting with them, huh?
That's right.
Leading them to their demise. Their cousin never visited. Elbow Bender. He was drunk all the time and he couldn't make the trip.
Elbow Bender. I didn't find him in my research.
That's Elbow's world.
Now, supposedly the Benders, like you said, there's not really much known about them, but there was some speculation that Paul Bender was actually born John Flitkinger and was possibly from the Netherlands, and Elvira was actually born Almira Hill Mark, and she was previously married to a Simon Mark and supposedly had 12 children. She also married, this woman, if this was her, also married other people, and all the husbands met an untimely demise too. So there's speculation that that's actually who she was, but it's not really known for certain.
They don't really know.
No. It's like, it was a different time back then.
Yeah.
So it kind of adds to the, I hate to use this word, but adds to the kind of the romance of the legend. You know, it's like,
The mystery, the
allure.
Yeah.
So they were around their bed and breakfast. Now, one of the first things that turned up in May of 1871, the body of a man named Jones had his skull crushed and his throat cut was discovered in Drum Creek. And the guy who owned the claim there was suspected, but no action was taken against him. Then in February of 1872, the bodies of two men were found that had very similar injuries of Jones. And by 1873, reports of missing people who had passed through the area had become so common that travelers began to avoid the trail. And the area was supposedly known for horse thieves and villains. And basically, a lot during that time, I mean, you got to think, they had just displaced the Native Americans. So a lot of times they would say, oh, there must have been, you know, some Native American raids, or it's lawless out there. There's horse thieves. It's just a dangerous area. It's a dangerous part of the country.
Probably got eaten by a bar.
That's right. And there were a lot of accusations about what happened to these people, because they were all pretty much killed the same way. So it starts becoming a little bit weird.
If only they had Mindhunter back then, they might have been able to figure it out.
That's a good show.
Yeah, I love it.
I enjoy it. I'm almost through the second season.
Oh, I finished it a few weeks ago.
Did you?
Yeah.
Now, one of the things, there's different theories about how...
And they looked at a lot of people, but the Benders had never come under suspicion. They were just thought of to be this nice family that housed people along the way and kept to themselves, and nobody thought anything about them.
I never suspected them. It's always the nicest neighbors. So there's some different theories about how they eventually came under scrutiny. One is that in the winter of 1872, so they'd been there a couple years, George Longcore and his daughter Mary Ann left Independence, Kansas to settle in Iowa, but they were never seen again. And then basically in the spring of 1873, this guy's former neighbor, a Dr. York, went looking for them and started questioning different homesteaders along that same trail, because again, there was really only one way to go to pass through there at that time.
He must have been a heck of a good neighbor.
I'd say so.
I mean, if one of my neighbors said they're moving and they went somewhere and they never... wrote back, or I never heard from him, I wouldn't think anything about it. And I certainly wouldn't go looking for him.
Well, it doesn't say it here, but I'm assuming that Dr. York loaned this guy money to help him move, and he never paid back.
Oh, you think that's what it was?
And that's not supported by any fact whatsoever.
Right. But, so there was more than just a, I wonder where my neighbor ended up.
Yeah. Where's that 50 spot that I left?
I see. Okay.
I think he had a pecuniary interest in it.
So he went looking for him, and next thing you know, he woke up dead.
So he reached Fort Scott, and then he began to return back to Independence from where he came, but he never arrived home. Well, Dr. York had two brothers, Colonel Ed York, who lived in Fort Scott, and Alexander M. York, who was a member of the Kansas State Senate. And they were kind of the well-to-do family. He was connected a little bit.
Right.
And they knew...
They got the wrong person.
Yeah, like this is a guy that just doesn't go missing.
Right.
And if he does go missing, somebody's going to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
And they both knew what his travel plans were, and when he failed to return home, they basically went out looking for him. Colonel York supposedly had a company of about 50 men, and he questioned every traveler along the trail and visited all the homesteads in that area. So Colonel York did not play around.
No, he was very thorough. He knew something was up, and he was going to get to the bottom of it.
So on March 28, 1873, Colonel York arrived at the Benner's Inn with Mr. Johnson and explained that his brother had gone missing and asked if they had seen him. They said, well, Dr. York has stayed with us, but maybe he ran into trouble with the Indians, which is supposedly what he had said. So Colonel York said, well, you know, that could be a possibility. Who knows? This is kind of a dangerous area. And he stayed for dinner. And on April 3rd, Colonel York returned to the inn with armed men after being informed that a woman had fled the inn after being threatened with knives by Elvira. So he found out like some woman had come running out of their inn after being threatened with knives. Supposedly, and this is the way the story goes, is that she could not really understand English. And the younger Benders were denying the claim that, you know, that they had hurt this woman or that they had seen or done anything to the brother and all that. And supposedly Colonel York repeated the claim again, and Elvira became so mad that in like perfect English, she broke out and cursed the men. And she said that the woman was a witch who had cursed her coffee and that they needed to leave the house. But supposedly, you know,
sense of the English language was much better than anyone thought.
Yeah, she doesn't speak any English, but all of a sudden she gets mad. She's like, get the F out of my house.
That's like that old lawyer trick with the guy with the neck brace that claims he has whiplash, and you drop the book and he turns and looks real fast.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like that. They repeated that claim and got her mad. And so then she spoke up. What do you mean? She deserved what she got. She was a witch. She cursed my coffee. You never curse somebody's coffee.
No. That would be really bad.
What I wondered was it like, this is the worst damn coffee I've ever had? Or was it like, I put a curse on your coffee so that when you drink it, you'll be even uglier than you already are.
May your beans be decaffeinated.
Yeah, I mean, which kind of curse did she mean?
I don't know. If somebody cursed my coffee, I'd be pretty upset about that.
Yeah.
I rely pretty heavily on my coffee in the morning.
I know. I'd hate to be drinking cursed coffee. I have had fish water coffee, but that's a completely different story.
Fish water coffee, you say?
Yes.
I'm going to have to ask.
Well, I'm not going to tell.
Okay.
That's an off-the-air story.
Point taken. So, before the colonel left that night, Kate, the daughter, supposedly asked him to return alone the following Friday night so she could use her clairvoyant abilities to help find the brother. And basically, the men with York were convinced that the Benders and a neighboring family, the Roaches, were guilty and wanted to hang them all. But York, being the colonel and very vigilant, said, no, we must have evidence. So,
yeah, he was he must have taken that lawyer code there, you think?
He probably was a lawyer. It seems like back then a lot of people were lawyers.
So. Yeah.
And about the same time, all the different communities were kind of starting to say, like, you know, we have had a lot of disappearances around here. Maybe we need to have a town hall meeting about this and kind of figure out what's going on. And so they had a town hall meeting at the Harmony Grove Schoolhouse, and supposedly the meeting was attended by 75 locals, which included Colonel York and John Bender Sr. and John Bender Jr. They were actually there.
Those two always turned up.
They did. And so basically they were discussing the disappearances, and they were talking about how William York had disappeared.
And if he didn't know English, why did he go to these meetings? Because he couldn't have understood anything going on. So I think that his grunting and everything, he knew a lot more than what he was letting on.
That could be the case.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a simple caveman lawyer.
Yeah, that's right.
And so basically, it was agreed that search warrants would be obtained for every homestead between Big Hill Creek and Drum Creek. And despite the colonel's strong suspicions about the Benders and his visit several weeks earlier, No one really watched them, and it was not noticed for several days that they actually disappeared. So
they done up and left.
This is kind of an interesting thing, too. They decide they're going to get search warrants for people's houses just because of where they live.
Right.
I don't know about that.
Somebody in this area done it, and ain't nobody leaving till we checked.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and guess that may be unconstitutional.
You think?
Yeah.
I think in 1871, they weren't enforcing the Constitution real strict-like.
Well, they would have, but probably not in some place that was not actually a state.
But now, wait a minute. When were those amendments ratified?
Well,
oh, they were ratified before then, weren't they?
No, well, the Constitution, shall issue no general warrants. That's
true.
That's pretty early. I think that's, what is the no general warrants thing?
Yeah, because that dates all the way back to when the English were still occupying. They were doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I don't think that would actually fly.
Bloody English people coming over and occupying our country.
But I'll tell you what, if somebody shows up with a ham sandwich and tells me it's a warrant and they have 50 armed men and I live in the frontier, I'm probably going to let them search my house.
I'm say, I'm going to eat that warrant.
So a few days after the meeting, Billy Toll, a local guy there, was driving his cattle past the Bender property, and he saw the inn was abandoned and the farm animals were unfed. And he went to the township trustee, who I guess was kind of like the mayor, and reported that. But there was kind of inclement weather, as you were...
Yeah, these guys had a real sense of urgency.
They did.
There was inclement weather, so they waited for a couple of days before they went out and checked.
They did.
And sure enough, they are gone.
So they formed a search party, which included Colonel York, and they arrived at the inn and found the cabin empty of food, clothing, and personal possessions. And here's kind of where it gets a little creepy. There was a bad odor, which was noticed, and they traced it to a trap door underneath, a bed nailed shut. So basically, there was a trap door in the house that led to a basement area.
Mm-hmm.
And they opened the trap, and there's an empty room underneath, and basically it had clotted blood all over the floor. There was a stone slab floor was broken up with sledgehammers, so they broke it all up there, and they did not find any bodies or anything like that. So here's one of the interesting things.
So they found blood, but they didn't find any bodies or anything.
That's right. So basically they determined that the smell was coming from the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did is, they actually lifted the cabin up and moved it to the side so they could dig under it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how in the world they did that. I mean, I imagine a cabin's got to be pretty heavy.
I bet there were horses involved.
There could be. Now, I mean,
maybe they just dragged it off its foundation.
If you see pictures of this inn or cabin or whatever on the internet, because there are pictures out there.
Yeah.
It's not very big.
Yeah, it was a tourist attraction for a while.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could imagine where basically... You know, they could probably move, but still, I mean, moving something like that would not be easy.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't find any bodies after moving the whole cabin. They didn't find any bodies. So basically what they did is they started to probe the ground around the cabin. They had a metal rod and started sticking it in the ground to see what they could find. And there were some areas where there was disturbed soil near the vegetable garden and the orchard. And I guess they were using them for fertilizer because they found Dr. York's body buried there later that evening.
No wonder them pumpkins was getting so big.
Yeah. And I don't know why this was mentioned, but he was supposedly buried face down with his feet barely below the surface. So maybe his toes weren't pointing up.
Yeah, that way you didn't have to dig as deep, I guess.
I don't know. and they continued to probe the area, and they found another 9 suspected grave sites before the men were satisfied they had found them all and retired for the night.
They could have been using them as a bicycle stand.
Who, the body?
Yeah.
Oh, to wheel a bike up?
Yeah. Keep the butt sticking up out of the ground.
Wedge it in?
Yeah, just put your bike there.
Oof, those were big wheeled bikes back then, too.
Those were big butts back then, too. I don't know.
So they resumed the next morning. They found another 8 bodies were found in 7 of the 9 suspected graves. And they found one in the well and a lot of body parts. And all of them but one had their head bashed in with a hammer and their throats cut.
So they had a distinct M.O.
Yeah, very much. So they did find the body of one young girl was found, but there was no sufficient injuries to see what killed her, so they think maybe that she was either strangled or buried alive.
Yeah.
Which is kind of grim. So now this is kind of the era, too, when newspapers were really taking off. And newspapers reported on this.
They wrote them like sensationalized stories.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
This was like quite the...
That's what sold newspapers.
Yeah. It was quite the big deal back then.
So you didn't just report the news. You reported it as a big phenomena.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, too, this is a similar era of like a Jack the Ripper type murders and things like
that.
It's that same kind of time period. And newspapers were flying off the shelves talking about this story. And basically, one Kansas newspaper reported that the crowd was so mad after finding the bodies that a friend of the Benders, a guy named Brockman, who was among the onlookers, was hung from a beam in the inn until unconscious, revived, and interrogated again as to what he knew, and then hanged again. And after the third hanging, they released him, and he staggered home as one who was drunken or deranged.
Well, if I'd been hung three times in one day, I would stagger home, too, like I was drunken or deranged. But that's frontier justice for you.
Yeah, it is. Supposedly, they found a Catholic prayer book in the house that had some notes written in it, which were in German, which were translated, Johanna Bender, born July 30th, 1848. John Gebhardt came to America on July 1st, 18, then ... Big slaughter day, January 8th, and hell departed. So the murders and word about it spread quickly. And more than 3,000 people, including reporters from as far away as New York and Chicago, came to visit the site there. And, I mean, you got to think, back then, to travel from New York to there.
That was like a week or so.
That was a big trip.
Yeah.
Probably even longer than a week.
Yeah, maybe a month.
Yeah. So, I mean, it became quite the tourist attraction. And people were basically taking things from the house, bricks, stones, anything they could grab off the house, and eventually it destroyed the house. And there was a state senator, an Alexander York, who was the brother of the aforementioned Dr. York, who was killed by the Benders. And basically, he offered a $1,000 reward for the Bender family arrest, and the Kansas governor offered $2,000 reward for the apprehension of all four. So basically, that was $3,000 total, which in today's money is about $60,000 to bring them to justice.
There's big money in them days.
There are. So basically, they surmised that the way the murders were committed was that when a guest would stay, and they know this because there were some people that had stayed there and had actually escaped.
Right.
Like, they just thought things were weird and, like, things were going on. So they basically figured out that what would happen is the host would give the guest the seat of honor at the table, which was positioned right over top of the trap door, which led into the cellar.
And now, also, it was right in front of that curtain.
It was right in front of that curtain. And there were a few guests that, like, refused to sit there in front of there because they didn't want to. And that's when the Benders got really mad and that guy started getting really upset because you're interfering with their plan.
And they would curse at him and run him off sometimes, and stuff like that.
So,
or the young Bender girl who was being flirtatious and, oh, yeah, you come over here and you do this. Well, when they didn't do what she asked, then she suddenly was not so friendly anymore.
And so while she was flirting with them and they were in the seat of honor, basically John Bender, Paul Bender, or his son would come over from behind the curtain and strike the guest on the right side of the skull with a hammer. And then the victim's throat was cut by one of the women to ensure the death. And then basically what they did is they flipped open the trap door and dropped the body.
Dropped down in.
And basically what they would do down in the cellar, they would strip the body and then later bury it somewhere on the property, usually in the orchard, I guess, to make sure the apples grew well.
That's so right.
They're trying to be very
very organic. That's where your organic vegetables come from. They're grown amongst decomposing bodies. It's a circle of life.
You know, it was probably pretty lucrative back then because most people, when they traveled, I mean, they had to carry their
everything
cash
with you them. Had. Yeah,
because they're moving out west.
Well, not only that, this is why some of their friends came under scrutiny. Is they would take their horses, they would take their guns, and they would take their pocket watches and anything else that they had. And so they had to have people sell these, because if they kept showing up with all this stuff and selling it themselves, people would get suspicious. So they had a whole group of other friends who were somewhat implicit, because they would sell these things off and split the money with them. And the other ones did it so they could get some of the money anyway, but they had to know something was going on.
Yeah. They probably so did.
There were rumors that there was most of that town of Osage was in on it and knew exactly what was going on, but they were all profiting from it.
Right, so they didn't really, it didn't bother them so much.
Yeah, yeah. And they were out of towners.
Yeah.
Nobody cares about out of towners.
Well, you know, the thing is too is that all those people immigrated there about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they were all kind of the same. They were all spiritualists and had the same beliefs and things like that. So there is probably something to be said that they may have been in on it a little bit too.
Now, the one thing you can say, it's not like, you know, when you think of serial killers, they get a thrill out of killing. And, you know, they do it purely for the sport or if you watch Mindhunter, the sexual gratification or whatever from it. But they were pretty pragmatic. They were killing for money. You know, they were doing it so that they could live a better life. So I doubt that it really bothered them that they were killing people, but at least it was just for the money. They were basically robbing them.
No, I mean, it was basically like a little factory.
Yeah.
Like they were very methodical about it.
Oh, yeah. You
know, they had them sit in the same seat, had a trap mm-hmm. door, curtain, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and there were ones, if they didn't have any money, if they were, for some reason, they got one traveling that was basically just begging his way along, they didn't bother them because they didn't have anything to offer. So they didn't just kill them because they showed up. They would just turn them away and not feed them or not let them stay, but they didn't keep them there and kill them because they were doing it for the money.
Some of the people that got away, there was a William Pickering, and he said that he refused to sit near the wagon cloth because there were stains on it.
Yeah, several of them made that comment that the cloth made them sick.
So he was,
it probably had blood stains all over from getting bashed probably in the head.
Yeah, because you just can't find those curtains everywhere out there.
That's right. Where are you going to find a wagon cover?
So Kate supposedly threatened him with a knife, and he ran. There was a priest who basically said he had seen one of the Bender men had a large hammer. He said he felt uncomfortable and he ran. Two men said they had traveled to see Kate Bender's psychic powers, and they stayed for dinner but refused to sit at the table next to the cloth and said they wanted to sit basically at the main shop counter. And then Kate became abusive towards them. And then two Bender men emerged from behind the cloth, and basically they started to feel uneasy and they just kind of ran out of there. And supposedly interesting, too, when they were basically going through this house, that they found more than a dozen bullet holes in the roof and on the sides of the cabin.
Uh-huh.
And basically they figured that probably what had happened is they had hit somebody with the hammer and not knocked him unconscious or just dazed him a little bit. So they pulled out their gun and tried to shoot him.
Right.
Or you know, the struggles ensued there. So
yeah, that somewhere, some of them, the people didn't go down just on the first blow or whatever. And they got their gun out and started shooting. But because they said the Benders didn't shoot anybody. They didn't find any evidence that any of the people that they killed had been shot.
No, they probably by that time had guns too.
Oh yeah. Well, they could have had the people's guns that they killed if they wanted them, but they were selling them.
Yeah.
They didn't want them to keep them. They were selling them.
So when they finally decided to depart to go look for the Benders, like I said, they didn't really hustle it up too much. It must have been a pretty bad storm. They found the Benders' wagon abandoned, and there were a starving team of horses, and it was just outside the city limits of Thayer, which was north, about 12 miles north of the inn. And it was confirmed in Thayer that basically they had bought tickets on the Leavenworth, Lawrence, and Galveston Railroad for Humboldt. And then it was discovered that at Chanute, John Jr. and Kate left the train and caught the MK and T train to the south to Red River County near Denison, Texas. From there, they traveled to an outlaw colony thought to be in the border region between Texas and New Mexico. But they weren't pursued, as lawmen following outlaws into that area often didn't come back. One detective...
That's pretty bad when the lawmen don't come back.
Yeah. One detective claimed that he had traced the pair to the border where he'd found that John Jr. had died of apoplexy. Apoplexy.
Easy for you to say.
Not really.
Apoplexy.
Apoplexy, exactly. Like he said. And Ma and Pa Bender did not leave the train at Humboldt, but continued on to Kansas City, where it's believed they purchased tickets for St. Louis, Missouri. So there were different groups of vigilantes that formed to try to find them. And there was a good amount of money on the line, too, if you did find them.
Yeah, and here's the where it really gets kind of sketchy, though. There were several different reports of people finding them, of these vigilante groups finding them and killing some of them, that the father broke down and confessed and started telling him what it was, and the son was saying, no, don't tell him. But here's the thing. Like you said, there was a reward of $60,000.
Yeah.
Why would
present day money.
Right. Why would people have taken the time to hunt them down, kill them, bury the bodies, and never turn them in? Because the bodies were never turned in. Nobody was ever turned in, and that reward was never claimed.
Nope.
So all these things, and then you had divergent stories about this group said they found them and killed them. Then there was another group supposedly found them and killed them. So the truth of the matter is, nobody ever really knew what became of them. I mean, it's probably most likely that they split up.
Oh, I'd say so.
Because the four of them traveling together would be suspicious, and so you'd think, well, maybe they'll split up or whatever and move on.
Yeah, often, actually, for 50 years after it, two women who were traveling together were often accused of being Kate Bender and her mother. Like, that was kind of a common thing that a woman and her child had to, like, be on the lookout for.
Yeah. Well, they said that when they searched the cabin after they found the bodies, they found three hammers. It said a shoe hammer, a claw hammer, and a sledgehammer that appeared to match the indentations in some of the skulls. I imagine that was a real scientific research there. Hold the skull up, hold the hammer. Yep, that fits. That matches. That's about right.
Doesn't quite fit. Let me wedge it in there. Yep, okay, yep, that fits.
And then it said, when attempts were made to relocate this museum, it had a museum built to them that was there in Cherryville, Kansas from 1967 to 1978. And then the site was acquired for a fire station. So they tried to move the museum, but some locals objected to the town being known for the Bender murders. And the Bender artifacts were eventually given to the Cherryvale Museum, where they remain in a wall-mounted display case. A knife with a 4-inch tapered blade was reportedly found hidden in a mantel clock in the Bender house by Colonel York. In 1923, it was donated to the Kansas Museum of History by York's wife, but is not on display, and it's still bearing the reddish-brown stains on the blade, and it can be seen upon request.
Yeah, supposedly you can still go see this stuff.
Yeah.
So it was reported in 1884 that a John Flickinger had committed suicide near Lake Michigan. And also in 1884, a man matching Paul Bender's description was arrested in Montana for murder near Salmon, Idaho, where the victim had killed with a hammer blow to the head. So kind of the same MO. And there was a message basically wanting identification and was sent to Cherryvale, but the suspect severed his foot to escape leg irons and bled to death. So whoever this person was cut their own foot off to get out of the leg irons and killed themselves. And a deputy from Cherryvale arrived to see if they could make an eyewitness determination if that was actually the father. But basically there was too much decomposition at that point, so he couldn't tell. So basically, even though there wasn't any kind of identification, the guy's skull that did this was displayed as Paul Bender in a Salmon saloon until probation forced its closure in 1920 and the skull disappeared. So
somebody took it home as a souvenir when bar closed.
I guess so. So that skull may still be out there. So nobody really knows what happened to him. It's kind of an unexplained mystery.
Well, let me follow it up with this. Have you ever heard of the Kelly family serial killers?
I think I've heard of it. I don't remember much about it.
Well, this was about 7 years after the Benders.
Mm-hmm.
Says, in the span of a few months, a number of people had disappeared mysteriously along the road leading to the Kelly Tavern. Despite this, nobody suspected the family of doing anything until around December of 1887, when the occupants suddenly left the house without notifying anybody. A short while after, a traveler from St. Louis named S.T. Gregg, who had visited the tavern before, decided to stop by and check the house. Upon entry, a foul stench overtook him, coming from the hidden cellar underneath the house.
Sounds
the
similar.
The bodies of three men already in an advanced state of decomposition were discovered, as well as a trap door under the tavern's floor. Gregg immediately notified authorities of the matter. Shortly after, search parties came pouring into the house, one of them being led by a cowboy named Texie. I bet they called him Sexy Texie. While digging around the barn in search of any other corpses, the men's attention was drawn to some loosened dirt to the left of the barn door. When dug up, a body with a broken skull was discovered, evidently murdered with an axe. Further digging revealed seven other bodies, two of them being of women, although a majority of the victims were decomposed beyond recognition. Three of them were identified from their clothing as local merchants and cattlemen, and a rusty old axe with human flesh on its blade, presumed to be the murder weapon, was also located.
Huh.
There are two broadly accepted accounts of the Kelly's fate. And it's talking about how they tracked them down. But here's the thing. There was four of them.
Yeah.
Serial killers. The family consisted of William Kelly, 55, his wife Kate, his son Bill, who also went by Billy, and Kit. Now, they were supposed to be, Billy was supposed to be 20 and Kit 18.
Mm-hmm.
And they're believed to have killed about 11 wealthy travelers. Now, yes, the ages are different, but everything else kind of matches. And it's,
I know.
You know, and they also, it was rumored that those two were not actually the children of the Benders, that they were actually just a young
couple.
Young couple.
Yeah.
Posing as father, I mean, as son and daughter, but that people from the area had seen them in a romantic way at times with each other.
Free love.
Yeah. So this seems, and this was also, this was still in Kansas. It was just a little bit away from where the other one was. So, and these guys, once again, there is nothing that says that they were actually found and killed. There's two different stories out about how they were found. And the final conclusion that they have is, according to news reports from contemporary media, an unnamed man from Kansas City who had investigated the notorious Bender family's house and the rumors of their deaths numerous times claimed that the Kellys were in fact the Benders. The man further elaborated that all the stories of the latter's capture were made up, supposedly by a group of Confederates who have also helped the Benders dispose of the murdered victims' horses and wagons. He pointed out that both families' modus operandi, family unit numbers, and other evidences proved that they are one and the same.
We'll never know.
No, but it looks like that they could have moved on and set up shop, just changed their name.
I mean,
and gone right back to the same thing.
That would make sense.
I mean, they could have been copycat killers.
Yeah.
They could have been in a place where they said, you know, we get people coming in. You know, I don't care if we kill somebody if they've got good money. And so they made their own. But I think it sounds a lot like that was the same group.
It very well could be. We may have just solved a mystery.
Well, we didn't. Somebody else did. We just read their information.
Oh, I thought we solved it.
No, we solved it for our listeners, but not for the world.
Have you ever seen a old movie from, I think it was 90 or 91? It was Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase. It was called Nothing But Trouble.
I don't think so.
Dan Aykroyd has a lot of makeup, and he plays this kind of old mayor of this town. And basically, they catch speeders that come into their town. They bring in front of the judge, and basically they steal their car and their money and things that. And so it's kind of a similar type setup like that.
But they don't kill them.
No, they kill them.
Oh, they kill them?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, it's like a dark horror comedy.
And who was in that?
Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase.
That doesn't sound like something they'd be in.
It's a really obscure movie. It was.
I guess so.
Well, you know, I grew up pretty close to a video store.
I know. I remember that.
I used to rent a lot of videos.
Yeah. They knew you on a first name basis.
Yeah.
But, you know, I thought it was strange because most of the time you think of serial killers and they're these lone wolves. They were rejected by their mother and beaten by their father, and they were sexually assaulted. And so they're going out and they're doing things to try to seek revenge on somebody somewhere psychologically that this is going to make them feel better or something.
You're getting to some Mindhunter territory now.
Yeah, right. That's where I learned it from. But here, you know, you think families that work together and do this together, family that spills together, kills together, or whatever. I don't know. But so I thought, you know, that had to be unusual. How could that be? So I looked to see if there were any other serial killer families of note. And apparently there are. Really? Apparently it's not that uncommon for families to decide to go into serial killing. Now, one other thing before we leave the Benders, I thought that would have made a great movie.
Yeah.
Why have I never seen a movie about that? And what's his name, Del Toro?
Benicio Del Toro?
Yeah, that's done a bunch of scary movies and stuff. He, at one point, 2012, I think, got the rights to do it, but then never made the movie. But I don't understand why nobody has. And then you could do the sequel, The Benders Return as the Kellys.
Yeah, it's right there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all right there. You show all the stuff going on, and then there's a sequel. So you got two movies right there in the bag. I think we need to work on that.
Let's do a script.
Yeah. Throw one together.
Let's get Justin work on it.
That's right. Somebody.
He's got all the connections.
Now, here's one. That's what made me think of that. Here's one that does have connections to a movie you've heard of. The Hills Have Eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's based on one from Scotland. The Bean Clan was a huge gang of cannibal murderers. And it was a clan that lived in a seaside cave. And when people came wandering into their areas, they would attack them and rob them and dismember them and eat them.
Mm.
And they were known far and wide. Everybody stayed clear of that. But the whole family was involved in it. They were incestuous, and so they just grew their own family from the inside.
I think that's kind of the similar plot to just that movie Wrong Turn.
That's supposed to be in West Virginia, too.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know how it wasn't? You know how you could tell it wasn't if you watched that?
How?
Did you notice what the trees are through that? All these tall pines everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
That's not... West Virginia is hardwood. It's not the softwood like that. And you know,
there are some pine trees, but not like
that. Not like that. No. No, that had to have been filmed either like Canada or the...
British Columbia.
Northwest or something like that, yeah.
They give them good tax credits up there.
That's right. The actual... There is actually the Guinness World Record of serial murders belongs to two sisters. Now, there was actually four sisters involved, the Gonzalez sisters. There was actually four of them involved, but two of them... Even though they benefited from it, once again, they were killing for money.
Yeah.
Even though the other two benefited from it and knew about it, they never got charged. They just charged the two that actively participated in it. And what they had done is they would advertise for maids to come work for them because they were supposed to be fairly well-to-do. Mm-hmm. But what they were doing is they were running a brothel. So these women that would show up, they would force them to go to work in their brothel, and if they didn't, they'd kill them. Or after they became old, or if they became not pleasing or whatever, they would kill them.
Yeah.
And then they also, so they ended up killing.
Basically, they'd kill them.
Yeah, they'd kill them eventually, one way or another. But eventually they killed 80 women and 11 men. The 11 men were killed because they had made the mistake of bringing a lot of money to the, with them when they came to the brothel. So they said, yeah, let's just go ahead and kill them.
Yeah.
So they killed 91 people.
Wow.
These two sisters.
That sounds almost like the H.H. Holmes, the guy in Chicago, too. The Devil in the White City.
Yeah.
You heard about him, too, right?
No, I didn't hear about
him. He's the one that had the murder hotel.
Oh, yeah. But he was just one guy.
He was, yeah.
See, this is a family we're talking about. This is a family show.
Well, this is about...
So we're talking about family serial killers.
Well, it's the same kind of, almost the same era, too.
The Harpy brothers were America's first serial killers. They were back... Of course, they were right back... in the same time frame as the others, the Benders, but they said that they killed, the Harpies murdered dozens of victims from Tennessee to Illinois. They often teamed up with other outlaws along the way, where their victims were mostly travelers or pioneers in small settlements. Huh. So the one, they were both from North Carolina, and one was tracked down and killed, and 4 years later the other one was.
I tell you, you've been watching a lot of Mindhunter.
Oh, I have been. I watched it. I watched it all, and I'm about ready to go rewatch it again for anything I missed. It was particularly good.
I kind of like the detail they put in the era. Like, I like a good period piece. Like, you know, the, all the cars.
Soundtrack is good too.
The soundtrack, the cars,
yeah,
the decorations in the apartments and houses.
All right, this is a Staffelback family. They were yet another family of serial killers to come out of Kansas. There's a lot of them in Kansas. I don't know what it is. Kansas was just lawless.
Bloody Kansas.
The mother, Nancy Staffelback, was known to be the leader of the family, which had lived a life of crime long before their murder spree started. In 1897, Nancy, her husband, and two of their sons were convicted of murdering a miner and dumping his body down a mineshaft. And despite being only convicted for one crime, many believe the Staffelback clan actually robbed and killed about 50 people, ooh, all clients of a brothel. So they evidently would get them coming or going from the brothel. This one was fairly... What? Oh.
Nothing.
They're always going and coming and coming and going and always too soon. The Wests were two of Britain's worst serial killers. This was Fred and Rose West. They were a married couple who killed at least 10 victims. This was fairly recent, during the 1970s and 80s in Gloucester, England. The West would find their victims by recruiting women to work as nannies for their children or picking up female hitchhikers. They would rape, torture, and eventually murder their victims. Unlike other families on this list, the West children were not participants in the crimes, but victims of them. Rose West killed her husband's 8-year-old daughter, Charmaine, in 1971, and though her husband did not participate in that murder, he did nothing about it. Many years later, the couple killed their 16-year-old daughter, Heather, when she told friends her parents were abusive. The Wests were finally arrested after another one of their daughters told a friend's mother about her abusive parents, and the woman went to the police. Investigators found the bodies of 10 women on the property. Fred West committed suicide before his trial, while Rose West was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. There are quite a few people that, families, that chose to go to commit murder together. But it's for profit, so
yeah,
you know, at least they had a good reason.
That's not a good reason.
Well, it's better than just the thrill of the kill.
So one of the thoughts about what happened to the Benders was that they possibly changed their name.
Yeah.
Which they maybe did. Maybe they became the Kellys.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I thought...
That would explain that.
I thought it was a good tie-in to a legal podcast, which is what this supposedly is, or allegedly is.
Well, you know, it didn't take much in those days to change your name.
It didn't.
You just showed up in a town and you said, hey, my name's Kelly now.
Yeah. But actually, if you want to do it in this day and age, there's a lot of process you have to go through.
Maybe this is why. Because serial killers, you can't find them because you don't know what their name is.
They ruined it for everybody.
Yeah. See, we wouldn't have all this stickler. We wouldn't have to have our ID in airports and TSA and all that kind of stuff if it wasn't for them.
So you can generally change your name for free after a marriage or divorce. But I would actually state that marriage or divorce is never free. So,
well... I guess you'll know.
And so the other time you can do it is you actually have to petition. This is going to talk about West Virginia law, is you actually have to petition the court and have a hearing on it to change your name. And so if you want to change your name or that of your minor child, basically you have to file a petition, a verified petition. And a verified petition basically just means that you're swearing that all the facts stated in the petition are true. So it means it has to be notarized. And you have to state that you have jurisdiction, that you are a bona fide resident of the county for at least 1 year prior. The reason why you want your name changed, the new name that you want, and that the name change is not for the purposes of avoiding debt or creditors, and that you're not a registered sex offender, that it's not for the purpose of avoiding any state or federal law regarding your identity, that the name change is not sought for any improper or illegal purpose, and that you're not a convicted felon in any jurisdiction, and that the name change is not for the purpose of evading detection, identification, or arrest by any local, state, federal law enforcement, and whether or not the petitioner desires to protect his or her identity for personal safety reasons.
Yeah, but if that is the reason you're changing your name, for any of those nefarious reasons that you've listed,
right,
you're not going to admit to that. You're just going to say, oh, yes,
well,
I agree.
You're going to verify in your petition, so you're basically, it's the same as an oath. You're going to take an oath and file that with the court.
Well, yeah, but if you're going that far, that's not going to matter to you.
Well, and so after you do that, after filing petition, at least 10 days before the hearing to consider the application, the person has to cause notice of time and place that the application will be made and publish as a Class 1 legal advertisement in compliance with the provisions of Article 3. So basically, you have to publish in the newspaper that you're going to have a hearing and basically set out the things that you said in your petition, like who, what your name is, what you want to change to, and things like that. And basically, if there's good cause, it can be a closed hearing, but generally it's an open hearing. And basically what you do is you go in front of the court, and there's not going to be any adversary there. Basically, you just petition the court yourself to do it. But the judge might ask you some questions. I've actually seen judges deny it before because the person had some mental health issues and the judge didn't allow it for that reason. If you go to the hearing and the judge determines that you don't have good cause or there's some reason, then basically the judge can say, no, I'm not going to change your name. But there has to be kind of a good reason. But again, the main purpose of this is to point out that you're not doing it for any kind of nefarious purposes. So,
but you said you have to post it in the paper?
Yeah, you do. You have to take
it. Do you do it or does the government do it?
You do it. You have to pay for it. So what would happen is you would go down to the clerk, you'd file your petition, and the clerk would say, you need to take out an advertisement. And they would basically give you a form that you would have to take over to like the Herald Dispatch or something like that and say, I need to post this as a legal advertisement. Then you would pay them. They would post it. Then once it's posted, the Herald Dispatch or the newspaper gives you an affidavit saying it was ran the paper from this date and this date in this section.
Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
You have? In the paper, I mean? Have you ever looked in the paper and seen
something? It's usually in the classified area.
Oh, I don't read that. I throw that part away.
Yeah, it's in the classified area. It says legal notices.
Huh.
There's all kinds of stuff that goes in there.
So. I've never looked at any of that. So. Yeah. I mean, I wonder if there's people that open the paper every day and look, I'm going to see who's changing their name today. By God, they better not be trying to pull one over or I'm going to nail them.
We do it at our office.
Yeah?
Yeah, we look at the legal notices every day.
Huh. Well, I guess there's people in law enforcement might check that out or something like that.
Yeah.
But the common ne'er-do-well like myself, we don't look at those kind of things.
So now there's one more interesting thing about the Bender story that we didn't talk about. Supposedly, and this is kind of one of those fact from fiction type things, again, we said this was about the time of Little House on the Prairie with Laura Ingalls Wilder and all that. Mm-hmm. Allegedly, she gave a speech at a book fair in 1937, and that was later transcribed and printed in 1978.
She being who?
Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Oh, okay.
And basically, she said that her father, Pa Ingalls,
was actually Pa Bender?
He joined in a vigilante hunt for the killers, and when he spoke of later searches for them, she recalled, "At such times, Pa always said in a strange tone of the finality, 'They will never be found.' They were never found later, and I formed my own conclusions why." So basically, she was trying to insinuate that her father killed the Benders.
Well, but here, once again, why would they not present them for the money? There was a substantial reward. Why would you just poo-poo that reward?
Isn't Michael Landon, didn't he pay?
Like, yeah.
Imagine Michael Landon breaking bad on somebody.
No. No. But he did have great hair.
He did.
When I made the decision to let my hair grow out, he was one of the ones I wanted my hair to look like.
He had
like.
Great hair on his head, too.
Him and Kurt Russell. Yeah. Him and Kurt Russell. I want to have hair like those guys. Yeah.
Did you hear my joke?
He had great hair on his head, too.
Yeah. Didn't he have like a big thing of chest hair coming out? Like,
well, I guess he did leave his shirt unbuttoned down low. That was in the days when hairy men were considered more macho, you know, like Tom Selleck and all that kind of stuff.
Or like having a nice beard.
Now you see these guys on there and they're shaving their chests. Here, they want the sleek look, I guess, so they're more aerodynamic. They can run faster and swim quicker or something. I don't know.
That's right.
Get away.
The T-2000.
When you're running away from Kansas
T-2000.
After murdering families or your family murdering others.
Well, that's going to bring us to...
Legal Breeze.
So Legal Breeze is a part of the show where we talk about different legal things we talked about in the podcast on this episode.
Or illegal things.
What was the Homestead Act?
The Homestead Act was an act that encouraged people to move into an area that they had moved Native Americans off of so that they would get in there and settle it.
And
they had to improve the land, and they had to get a proper deed to it and everything. They had 7 years to do it.
Do you remember the three-step procedure I outlined?
They had to claim it and improve it, and they had to put up a home and a barn. Maybe have a few cows and a pig. Yeah.
No, they had to file an application, improve the land, and then file for the patent. And so they had to
patent the same as a title.
Yep. They had to reside on land for 5 years and had to complete the whole thing within 7. So
you couldn't just save it for later for a vacation spot or something.
No, they wanted people actually
living
doing
there.
It now and getting yeah. it. Getting it.
That's where the laws like adverse possession came into effect.
That's right. Well, yeah, kind of.
To combat that, people just stockpiling land and not using it.
Now, whenever they found out that there were all these bodies, they said they were going to have search warrants for everybody that lived in that area.
Right.
What was the problem with that?
Well, it violates the Constitution because it's not specific.
That's right. A search warrant for a house needs to have, well, first of all, it has to be supported by some sort of probable cause, and then it has to be kind of a very specific area that it's going to be searching.
Yeah, you can't search warrant a city.
No, you cannot search
warrant
a city.
Or a town.
That is that's called martial law, and it's not allowed.
You would have to pinpoint who your search is performed against, and they didn't even have anybody who. They didn't even have a who. They just had a place.
Yeah.
And it was a whole town.
And that's part of the problem, too, with these murders and things like that and the vigilante justice, is that even though this is taking place in present-day Kansas, they didn't have the Kansas annotated code there to turn to and say, oh, well, here's what the penalty is for murder.
Yeah.
That didn't exist back then.
And the penalty for being the friend of a murderer is they hang you 3 times and then let you stagger home.
That's right. Now,
he was a foot taller after that.
They called him Stretch.
Yeah. Are you rubbernecking again?
So I outlined a bunch of things that you have to allege in your petition if you're going to change your name. Can you give me a couple of them?
Well, you said you have to swear. I want to change my name.
It has to be a verified petition. And what is a verified petition?
That means that you are saying that everything in there is true.
That's right. And the way it's verified is you sign it in front of a notary that basically says that I verify that everything I said in this petition is true.
Right.
So
I said, do you swear? Yeah, and I drink and I have sex too.
And that's what makes it a verified petition, is that little thing at the end with the signature and the notary, which basically you're attesting that it is all accurate. So now if I'm an attorney and I'm filing a petition for a name change, I can go ahead and sign my name to it as well, but I'm going to have my client sign it and have it notarized too. Just because I'm an attorney doesn't mean I can kind of get around this whole verified petition type thing. Where the code says it has to be a verified petition, mm-hmm. it has to be a verified petition.
Right.
So, now, can you name some of the things you have to state in that petition?
That you're not trying to get out of a debt or changing it to avoid prosecution or because you want to do bad things or because of you're a sexual predator or you're trying to avoid paying alimony.
Yeah, no nefarious reasons.
Yeah.
So, and then what was the one thing that you were kind of surprised about?
You have to put it in the newspaper.
That's right. You got to publish.
Yeah.
So it's kind of got the elements of that you think you might need in order to have any kind of legal thing. You have to have
publish or perish.
You have to have jurisdiction. You have to say you live in the area. You have to allege certain things, and you have to give notice. So those are kind of the hallmarks of any good kind of legal proceeding.
Do actors do that? You think Madonna changed her name to Madonna, or does she just call herself that, but all her legal documents are really her, what is it, something like Jenny Chicarillo or something like that?
Yeah, Janine. I think probably some people actually do legally change their name, and others actually might actually form some sort of corporation or a fictitious name and make that like their intellectual property, like, you know.
But they don't really change their name.
No, but they own their own.
Think about when Prince changed his name to that non-pronounceable symbol.
Yeah.
Well, you can't swear that because you can't say it.
No.
I swear you can't say it. That's what I swear.
The artist formerly known as Prince.
Yeah.
Because he's passed away.
But it's not his name.
No. Well, that's going to do it for the legal briefs. So we were able to sandwich in some legal jargon there.
Yeah, we force-fed it in there.
But the Bender story is pretty interesting. I wonder if it has anything to do with the Bender character from Futurama. That was like the reason they said that was his name.
I doubt it. I don't think that had anything to do with it. But I was trying to tie it together with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, kind of like a modern version of that. If they just, you know, if the thing that drew everybody to the Bender inn was this delicious barbecue they served, mm-hmm. now you've got a story. See, we got to get writing, Mike. We got to get writing on our Bender story.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine podcasts.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome once again to Tommy's Random Thoughts. Today's random thought is newspapers. You may wonder, newspapers? Why newspapers? Well, because newspapers are falling by the wayside. I'm one of those kind of old curmudgeon-y guys who likes to get his newspaper and sit there with his cup of coffee and read the newspaper. I know you can find stuff online, but the truth is, nowadays, who knows what's real and what's the Russians? They put out all kinds of things online. You can't believe everything you read. You don't really know where your news is coming from. I know I see people online often comment about things they can't believe this is true, and they're reading an article from The Onion. If you can't believe this is true, and it's an article from The Onion, it's because it's not true. But people don't know the difference. But the newspaper, like the one we have here locally, yes, we're in a fairly small town, but we've always had a robust paper. At one point, we even had a morning paper and an evening paper. I know, because I used to help pass them. But they've consolidated it and cut it down, and now we don't even get a Monday paper. They don't even deliver one on Mondays to save money. They smash things together so we only have two sections. Dear Abby has really taken a beating. She only gets in one letter now. And usually the letter's not very good. Kind of lost interest in Dear Abby. The comics are getting old. It's the same ones. And they're not even funny. They shouldn't call them the funnies anymore because they're not funny. And then there's Dilbert. Dilbert used to be my favorite cartoon, but Dilbert hasn't been funny in a long time. But newspapers, I realize, are going to fall by the wayside. And people will be staring at their computers or staring at their screens and getting all their news. Mary tells me it shouldn't even be called a newspaper. It should be called an old paper because everything you read in a newspaper happened yesterday. And if you're anywhere connected, you already know about it. So it's actually old news. So I guess it is an old paper. This has been Tommy's Random Thoughts.